This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
This audio interview is sponsored by Dräger Safety, the worldwide leader in gas detection and respiratory protection. Wherever human breath is endangered, Dräger products provide life safety equipment. Dräger's motto is technology for life. For more information, visit www.dräger.com or call 1-800-615-5503.
Domestic Preparedness is with Dr. Paul E. Jarris, the Executive Director of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Dr. Jarris came to ASTO from service as Vermont's Commissioner of Health, and his career is very varied. He's served as the medical director of Vermont's largest nonprofit HMO, Community Health Plan, and as president and CEO of Vermont Permanente Medical Group, as well as CEO of Primary Care Health Partners, Vermont's largest statewide primary care medical group. Throughout his career, he's maintained an active clinical family practice, and he also holds an MBA degree and is board certified by the American Board of Family Medicine and the American Board of Medical Management. We're going to get the perspective of the state health official today, the state and territorial health official, on a host of public health preparedness issues. So, Dr. Jarris, thanks for hosting us today in your new offices here in Crystal City, just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C.
It's my pleasure, John. Thanks for asking.
Well, let's start our discussion with the ASTO view of public health infrastructure. Your general policy statement speaks of four essential components for governmental public health infrastructure, and those are trained and sustained workforces, health and medical data systems, reliable communications, and surveillance systems. So let's take some time to get your report card on each of those.
Well, with regard to preparedness, there's been a tremendous amount of effort and focus in the public health community, both at the state, local, and federal level. The workforce has completely transformed. People no longer just simply work on the area. They are no longer a nurse that gives vaccines or in a WIC clinic. They all pull double duty in the emergency preparedness world, and at any time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, know they can be called in to respond. Mm-hmm. So it's been a major transition in the field from one that a generation ago or even a decade ago perhaps was a daytime job to one we're now first responders, as is law enforcement, fire, and other first responders. That is, of course, a challenge in that we need to continue the staffing and the training and on an ongoing basis. And like our other first responder colleagues, we need to drill, and improve on those drills. Mm-hmm. So I think we've made a tremendous transition as a field. We've learned a lot from our colleagues in law enforcement and fire and the military about how to do this. And, in fact, much of our workforce has been recruited from those areas, and they're great partners to have in our agencies now.
What about the health and medical data systems?
Well, this represents a tremendous opportunity for all of us. There's a significant amount of emphasis going now into building electronic medical records, and those are often built as a network in a jurisdiction that may be a state. In some cases, we're looking in regions across the country. The ultimate goal is to have a single interoperable system across the country. The opportunity here is to integrate the public health system and the preparedness system with that clinical system so that we can actually look at what is being diagnosed and where, not necessarily who the individual is because we need to preserve their privacy, but use that data to mine it to see, are there outbreaks going on? Are there runs on particular types of medicine going on? Are there admissions to hospitals in a given pattern? And we're already seeing a number of states develop this capacity. I spoke with a epidemiologist from one of our states at a meeting recently who said that they noted a cluster of respiratory illnesses in children and adults in a given area, multiple different hospitals. So the system never would have been caught without an electronic surveillance system. They investigated, and it turned out that the common point between all these people was a school. They were teachers and students. When they went in to investigate, they found that a can of mace had been set off at the air intake at the school, and children and teachers became ill and went to different hospitals. The connection simply would not have been made before. Mm-hmm. Now, this was a prank, not terrorism, but it's not a far stretch from a prank like that to a terrorist event. So that there's tremendous potential there. Like the intelligence community, we'll have to deal with the issue that this will yield lots of data, and how do we sort through that data to truly know what's meaningful and what's noise? And that'll be another area we'll have to learn from our other colleagues in law enforcement and others who work with this type of data more frequently.
Now, I noticed an interesting term in the ASTO General Policy Statement, and it's not one that I'm familiar with, evidence-based public health. What does that mean, and how does it relate specifically to preparedness?
Well, it's very important that we know that what we're doing makes sense. Often we take on, in any field, take on ideas, promote initiatives because they sound good. But it turns out later that they don't make a difference. And in my own, I'm a physician and I've seen patients, and we've recently had several different areas in which we were doing things that we thought was the right thing and turned out not to be the right thing. I'll give you an example that probably most of your listeners have heard of. We were using hormone replacement in many women, believing that it would prevent bone loss and osteoporosis. Well, it turns out, if we studied that rigorously, more women were dying from that treatment from heart disease, even though their bones were healthier. Mm-hmm. Not a good idea. But it wasn't until we studied it we knew that. The corollary in public health, and I'm sure the same is true in law enforcement and fire and others, is that we need to study what we're doing to make sure it actually is accomplishing what we're setting out to accomplish. Now, there's two aspects of that. One is we need to take those programs that we've studied and found to be effective and spread them and use those as a basis for our programs. On the other hand, we can't let it slow us down. We need to innovate. We need to take what is known to work and innovate from that and then study it. I sometimes hear people say, well, what's the evidence base? You can't do that program. It's not been studied. Well, that's not how innovation works. So the exciting part for all of us is to take the known and improve upon it.
In this segment, let's now talk about preparedness. You represent the state medical officer view, so how well have states been able to integrate preparedness responsibilities and resources into public health, and in your view, what still needs to be done?
As I mentioned earlier, it's been a major transformation. The field of public health, we always responded to floods, to fires, fires and chemical plants and things, but now I think we've, by working with our other first responder colleagues, law enforcement, National Guard, military, fire, we can work as more of a unit and in, and in coordination with them. So it's been tremendously gratifying and exciting. I think one of my closest colleagues in Vermont was Commissioner Sleeper, the Commissioner of Public Safety. And not only did we work so closely together on preparedness, but there were many benefits from that in other areas. He and I worked very closely on drug abuse because we had developed the partnership around preparedness. And so we could be much more effective as a team of law enforcement and health standing up there. The same with fire safety. There are numerous programs where public health people are going into apartments and others and looking at smoke detectors and looking at carbon monoxide detectors, as well as taking care of the food or nutrition of the population. So not only preparedness, but across the board, these relationships are valuable. And it's been fun because, frankly, we have different cultures. And it's been very fun to learn the rules of how law enforcement works, which is somewhat different than public health. But I think it's gone well. We continue to need to work closely together and integrate because it still doesn't always come as obvious to someone when they respond, for example, to a white powder incident, if the fire chief is the incident commander, to make sure that the public health is there doing the tracking. I think it's not as automatic as I'd like it to be and, and as it will become.
Well, I guess exercises help in that, so I'd be interested to know how exercises and indeed real-life events, such as you have already indicated, are validating the strategic performance capacity indicators. And can you tell us a little bit about how that's going?
Well, you know, it's going well, and it's another exciting area in our field in that those are the states that are most successful, and I think most have adopted this, are using each event that occurs to exercise their emergency response system. The flu vaccine shortage of a couple of years ago, perfect opportunity to exercise mass vaccine clinics so that you could stand up and distribute those. In the state I came from in Vermont, We worked with all our agencies. Law enforcement was doing the traffic control. The EMSs were there. And we gave 8,000 vaccines in about 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
We stood it all up and did it. And so from that, we study it and we learn it. Now, is that an incident of terrorism? No. But mm-hmm. but it gave us a great opportunity to study, so we know what we would do in a pandemic influenza or if we had a chemical mm-hmm. event where we mm-hmm. had to give antidotes. So whether it's a flood, I recently knew of one state that used the flood, an impending flood, to exercise hospital evacuations. Mm-hmm. And they were ready to evacuate the state mental hospital, which was near the river that was going to flood. So we've moved to that culture where we take every opportunity to exercise components of the system. Now, the big exercises where we all get involved are also critical, where we make sure that everyone in the orchestra can play together. And those are major events, take a lot of planning.
Mm-hmm.
But by exercising the components, we're that much better when we do the mass exercises.
Dr. Jarris, let's look at incident command. Are you satisfied with the role that state public health agencies are playing in ICS under NIMS? And if not, how do we change that? What are some of the initiatives that are underway?
Well, you know, I am satisfied, and it's one of those gratifying areas where, you know, in the last 6 years, we've completely transformed our field. I remember when I first came on as the commissioner in Vermont having a discussion with someone from the CDC and some local people there about, oh, ICS will never work for public health. And I couldn't quite understand why not. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it has. We've learned from the fire service, from law enforcement, from others who use this and, in fact, recruited many of them to train us. And so ICS now is just second nature in public health mm-hmm. as of others. As a health commissioners and health officials, we're fully integrated in the state EOCs.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, each health agency has its own EOC that you can mm-hmm. stand up in a matter of minutes and staff.
Mm-hmm.
So we adopt it. We use it now. As I was mentioning for you earlier, we use it for floods. We use it for fire. We use it for outbreaks. You name it.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
that structure works.
Mm-hmm.
So we're grateful, actually, for our colleagues in other areas that have brought this technology and methodology to us.
Yeah. Now, is there a clear delineation of roles and responsibilities in your judgment?
Well, I think ICS is well structured mm-hmm. to do that. Mm-hmm. No matter what the situation is, there are clear roles that are, if you will, generic
mm-hmm.
That we've adopted also. The only point I think that we may need to work on is, and I think that during the SARS episode in Toronto, they worked on it, is who is overall in charge if it's clearly a health event.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in Toronto, the health official and the law enforcement official jointly were in mm-hmm. charge of it. Those types of relationships should be worked out ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
If it is a pandemic influenza, certainly that will impact our entire infrastructure and capacity mm-hmm. across the board. But who will be in charge? We should think about it.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily argue that it ought to be a health official or not, but I think we just don't want to be figuring that out in the middle of an event.
Sure. Well, I noticed that in one of your documents, you talk about one workforce, in quotes, in public health, and that in the context of what ASTO regards as building the state's preparedness capabilities. Can you tell us a little bit about what it means, the term?
Well, you know, it means a number of different things in different contexts, but one workforce within our public health agencies means, as we said before, it doesn't matter what your job is. In an emergency, you're mm-hmm. part of the emergency response workforce. You have a second job that you're mm-hmm. always doing also. So that's one workforce, getting over the notion of, well, wait a minute, I was a immunization nurse. Well, what mm-hmm. am I doing in the EOC? Well, that's the way it is, and people have embraced that and actually are very rewarded by knowing that they can serve the public in that way.
Mm-hmm.
The other one workforce refers to the fact that there is no significant event that does not involve local, state, and federal. And we as an enterprise in public health need to be aligned oriented toward solving the public's problems and meeting their needs and not have jurisdictional issues between us or to minimize those jurisdictional issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both a horizontal thing across different specialties and mm-hmm. a vertical issue about different jurisdictions mm-hmm. in government.
Mm-hmm.
To go broader than that, which I think is what we're facing in the future now, we also need to integrate with our other colleagues. For example, if we had a significant pandemic influenza where we were using isolation or quarantine,
mm-hmm.
we have to work out with law enforcement, what is our respective roles? Mm-hmm. Now, in SARS and in Toronto and others, the state-of-the-art practice is to have a voluntary quarantine, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they found actually that when somebody breached the quarantine and went out or breached isolation, they could almost always talk them back in. Mm-hmm. However, there may be an event where we can't talk a group of people back in. And then for law enforcement, what are their rules of engagement? How do they protect themselves? What about the escalation of force? Those things, again, need to be worked out ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Now, there is one more one workforce issue that is worth bringing up. And that is that because now everybody does double duty and both does their regular job and responds in the face of emergency, that creates much more need for training, much more need for drills, and yet there's only one workforce out there, but they now have two jobs. So we have a significant issue with supporting sufficient staff and training to get their day job done as well as their emergency preparedness job done. Mm-hmm. And so much of what we invest in is actually human capital. Yes, you need to have extra ventilators and machines and telecommunications, but ventilators don't intubate people by themselves. You mm-hmm. need to have a trained workforce. And this is a continual struggle for us to make sure we have the appropriate mm-hmm. funding and resources to maintain a highly trained workforce.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the interfaces at the HHS level for the state medical officers. Talk to us a little bit about the interfaces with NDMS now that it's at HHS and also the Public Health Service and the Medical Readiness Corps and other entities.
Well, we felt strongly that the health and medical services under NDMS should be in a health agency. Mm-hmm. We feel that the critical piece here is the health and public health knowledge. So we're fully supportive of this being in HHS. We're very excited to have Admiral Vanderwagen in mm-hmm. a coordinating function. We respect him tremendously as a colleague and as a leader. I think he's in a new position and is establishing that role. We're excited about it, and we hope to support him in that. Mm-hmm. What we want to make sure as we go forward is that all these programs are coordinated, the hospital programs, the state and local preparedness programs, the pandemic initiatives, influenza initiatives, because when you're actually in a community, it all comes together. Those hospitals mm-hmm. are part of your response system. They're not a separate parallel system. The EMS squads are part of your system. The clinical system, the medical system is part of your overall preparedness. And we feel very strongly that we do not want these things separated out and mm-hmm. run in parallel systems. We support the way HHS has done this in the past in coming to the states as the coordinator in their jurisdiction. That, and with that, we were able to bring hospital associations and hospitals to the table to work with us in a way fully integrated with the state response plan. Mm-hmm. And we're very concerned about any attempt to fund that separately, because that then could tear away at the very fabric that mm-hmm. makes this one system of response.
Mm-hmm. In this segment, let's now talk about ASTO's views on infectious disease policy. Dr. Jarris, what's your take on the development of a national surveillance strategy and system? Where are we and what still needs to be done?
Well, I think this is essential to have. I mean, we want as much information as we can. Much of our surveillance now is through the reporting of communicable diseases, and there are reporting laws in all states. That works well, that whether that's a physician or a laboratory, they will call their state agency, in some cases a local agency. That all is entered into a national system. But that's a very specific, when you get that report from a laboratory and you know what the bug is. At the same time, though, we need to cast our net wider and start doing this syndromic surveillance. We're based on diagnoses in emergency rooms, lab tests orders, medicines ordered. We can also look for patterns out there. And from those patterns, have an epidemiological investigation to see, is there anything behind this? Is it simply a viral gastroenteritis outbreak, or is this perhaps a food contaminated food outbreak? The recent success we saw in this was with the E. coli outbreak in spinach. Now, the real question is, why did it happen in the first place? But it did happen. So then we go on to how quickly did we respond to us. The first cases of the gastroenteritis from the E. coli came in early September of 2006. local departments in Wisconsin started picking up clusters of ill people. They then reported the state. The laboratory started doing testing, and they did identify the E. coli bacteria that these people were ill with, but they still didn't know why they were ill. They just knew there was a cluster. They reported that to the CDC through a national system we have. Mm-hmm. Coincident to that, there were outbreaks in Oregon, and Oregon was able to culture an E. coli bacteria from bagged spinach. Because those systems reported into the CDC, they could tell that they found that the E. coli in the spinach in Oregon was the same E. coli making people sick in Wisconsin, identified a national recall of bagged spinach occurred. Mm-hmm. That never would have happened without a surveillance system. Mm-hmm. So there are tremendous successes like that. It doesn't replace the reporting that is done by laboratories and physicians. It doesn't report the system we have, what are called sentinel practices. So, for example, for influenza, there are groups of family practices and pediatricians and internists who, if they get someone coming with a flu-like illness, will actually do a laboratory culture to see, is it an influenza? Mm-hmm. So what it does, though, is it casts the net wider. It adds a sensitive detection method, but not a specific one. So we don't know whether those reports are actually an outbreak of something, but it allows us to allows us to investigate it further. ASTO is working with the CDC on a project around their BioSense system to see how we can spread an interoperable system as rapidly as possible across the country. The critical point here that we want to make, and one of the reasons there's been problems in the past, is the interoperability has to be there. If there is an outbreak, if there is data or information or a cluster that has to be investigated, that investigation will happen at the state and local level. State and local jurisdictions need to get that report. At the same time, it would go to a federal jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Attempts in the past to have this go into the federal system and not hit state and local were resisted because it's the state and locals who actually can get on the ground, can get to that restaurant, can get to that farm as quickly as possible. Likewise, when these events may have a bioterrorism component to them, certainly our colleagues across the board in Homeland Security need to know about it. But it would be a mistake to first have that go to Homeland Security because there's a lot of noise in the system. It may not have anything to do with bioterrorism. It may just be a typical outbreak of gastroenteritis. So why not have the experts on the ground investigating it first before we, you know, blow the whistle and say there's a major event going on?
Mm-hmm. Doctor, there are big issues surrounding legal authorities in public health law. It's the state or territorial health officer who has the authority to impose isolation or quarantine. So what's your read on what needs to be done in the reexamination of the federal, state, and local public health laws that cover this?
There's been a considerable amount of work ongoing in this area for a number of years now. So all the states currently have assessed and in most cases revised their laws, the relevant laws around isolation and quarantine. So we're comfortable that is in progress. We are now moving into the more specific area of looking at social distancing. So we're supporting with the CDC a project called the Social Distancing Law Project. What this means is, for example, in the case of a pandemic influenza, the social distancing would mean cancellation of events, school closure, looking at mass transit, and other issues like that. Now, isolation and quarantine would again be a part of that. So we are looking to clarify the roles there of the state health officials and the laws on the states. I think we, in most cases, have what we need on the books, but the real issue here to me is not necessarily what's on the books, it's how do we make it happen? How do we make it work? If we're going to go into close a major university's football game, we certainly want our colleagues in law enforcement to be involved with us here because I wouldn't want to be the one standing in front of the ticket booth. So, getting back to the integration across all the Homeland Security fields, we need to make sure that we can actually do this in a way that's, one, the political leadership will understand the need for doing it, and two, that both the political leadership and the public will support. If we look back to 1918 in Philadelphia, there was a war bond parade that was scheduled to go on right when the 1918 influenza was beginning. Mm-hmm. And the health agency wasn't able to convince the political leadership to cancel the war bond parade. Mm-hmm. It was felt that would somehow be not patriotic, not supporting the war. They held it, and people just started dying within days. So we need to think that ahead of time, and all of the Homeland Security, public health, and clinical sector needs to be on the same page.
Now, that brings to mind vector control programs in terms of the spread of disease. How successfully are your folks working with locals and the feds in developing implementation approaches?
I think it is successful. And the interesting thing about this is I don't know that we'll ever have it conquered. I mean, when we look at what's happened here, mosquitoes weren't that much of an issue, and then West Nile popped up and Lyme disease popped up a few years ago, and we're continuing to see new bugs develop. So we really have to remain vigilant. Mm-hmm. The other question for us that we're exploring now is with global climate change, what will happen to the patterns? Will we see a spread in the territory of different mm-hmm. vectors? Could malaria possibly return to this side of the border? And many other, dengue fever and other things which we take for granted as not having, may reappear. We already are seeing the spread of bacterial illnesses, a bacteria named Vibrio, which is in shellfish and in seawater. And we're seeing dramatic increases in both infections and in what we would otherwise call food poisoning from this as mm-hmm. the water temperatures warm. So there's a lot of work we're going to have to look at here with regard to climate change, as well as just making sure we remain vigilant in controlling the vectors we know that are out there.
I want to go back to the linkages with the HHS. We've talked to a number of the senior officials there at the department about things like the alert system and laboratory response. Let's talk about Laboratory Response Network. What's your take on that initiative, and is it meeting the needs of the states?
The tremendous amount of work has been done with our laboratories. We're very proud of them, and we're proud of the partnerships they have across the public health community. The development has been dramatic. The upgrading of our laboratories has been important. What we have to recognize here, and the thing that we're most concerned about, is that you don't simply buy a machine and put it on the shelf. You have to buy a maintenance contract with that machine, and if you don't, you're not going to get it serviced, or you'll be at the end of a queue, and it won't be serviced when you need it. So there's a considerable expense to maintaining that machine. You also need to have two or three deep people trained on that machine and proficient, meaning that they are running samples on a regular basis. Now, you may not have to run a sarin or an anthrax test for real very often, but you need to be training and running those people. So one of the issues we're facing now is an attitude we see growing that, well, you bought the machine, so you don't need any more money for your laboratories. And that's simply not true, and I think people don't understand mm-hmm. the upkeep and maintenance of those. I think law enforcement with their forensic labs and probably fire services with their forensic labs have the same issue. So we all mm-hmm. should be talking off the same page on this.
Dr. Jarris, what about the CDC health alert system? How's that working for you?
It's very useful. It's very helpful. I get them on my BlackBerry all the time, no matter where I am. The same is true in the states and local areas. Within the states, we have developed the capacity to get out health alerts very rapidly to relevant parties, medical and communities that need to know. That is often now by email. It may be by blast fax. In some cases, it's telephone. So that capacity has developed redundancy mm-hmm. And is much more efficient than it was just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. One of the areas we'll have to look at is integration. What can be shared between the different responders in Homeland Security and what can't be shared? Mm-hmm. Because if we all have the same knowledge, we're much better off. I mean, law enforcement may, for example, have arrested a suspicious character at a border crossing. Well, they might really want to know that we're also identifying a cluster of illnesses, and vice versa. It may help us know when those cluster of illnesses are potentially a terrorist event if we knew that they had a person of suspicion that they had arrested. So that integration has yet to come.
Now, in this segment, I want to talk a little bit about antiviral stockpiling, which I know is an ASTO concern. The association wants more money to go into stockpiling for the influenza antivirals. At present, the government is providing for 25% of the need, or 81 million treatment courses. Would you tell us your thoughts on that and how you justify balancing an increased requirement with other public health priorities?
Yeah, and to be clear, we think antivirals are one tool in our toolbox for a pandemic influenza, and we don't think they're the only tool. We also don't think that we should divert a disproportionate amount of money into them and not be prepared in other ways. The target federally has been 25% of the population, or 81 million treatment courses for response, or again, treatment, not prophylaxis. Mm-hmm. We feel, though, that again, we need to balance that with other needs. We need to have the medical surge capacity, and we need to have, for example, the ventilators, the masks, and all the other things that are going to be necessary. Alternative sites of care, for example. We need to handle the issue that if schools are closed, kids need to be fed. So there's so many other needs, both infrastructurally and healthcare, that we don't want to solely focus on the antivirals. Having said that, the states, the federal government has put a significant amount of money in, but the states have put a significant amount of money in. And we have recently, as 2 weeks ago, resurveyed all the states. They do all intend to buy their federal allotment of the antivirals, which is a considerable amount of money across the board. We'll see $500 million going into this. One of the key issues for us to look at is the distribution system still needs to be worked out, because the clinical sector likely will be overwhelmed in the face of a pandemic. So how are we going to distribute this? The states are all drilling that at this point. We believe that an appropriate and perhaps the best model would be to have this as a federal asset within the SNS, which resides in the states. And there's a couple advantages to this. One is we think that the federal government does have a significant role in, and we would like to see increased role in financing the antivirals. But the advantage of putting it in the SNS is it remains a federal asset in the states. And what's critical about that is the federal government has what's called a shelf life extension program for their antivirals. So they can actually test those antivirals, and instead of throwing them out at 5 years, they can extend that under the federal program. The federal program does not extend to the states at this point. So by having this purchased by the states, owned by the states, and residing in the states, in 5 years we're going to be throwing out $500 million worth of medicine, and we can't afford to do that. ASTO is working very hard on trying to develop an approach to this. How can we extend the shelf life? It is very likely that the shelf life of these medicines is at least 7 years, if not 10 years. But so just going from 5 years and increasing those additional 2 years would be saving $200 million across this country. We can't in good conscience spend our taxpayers' dollars and not look at how to preserve it.
Now, I understand also that ASTO sees the Chempac program as the best model for antiviral storage. Now, in that sense, though, you're arguing to shift the storage responsibility from CDC to the states. Is that right?
Yeah, the we're happy with the Chempac program. We think it works well. What we again think is that in this way, you'll have a federally owned asset which can be managed through the shelf life extension program, and we're very comfortable to have that in the states and do the distribution of it. That capacity we've built in all the states and could easily extend it here. And think again, that would be well worth those hundreds of millions of dollars that will save the taxpayers.
Dr. Jarris, let's now talk about the vaccine supply. Do you have any concerns about the state's ability to meet the immunization needs of the population today?
There are several concerns which we consider very significant. First of all, we simply don't have the resources to fund the vaccines that we know children and others should be getting. For example, just in the year 2000, it costs around $280 to fully vaccinate a child. Here we are in 2007, and it's now over $1,100 to vaccinate a child. So it went from $280 to $1,100. The appropriations have not gone up. The money has not increased. So we're at a point where we simply do not have the resources to immunize our population. Now, why should we care about that? Well, if our first responders get measles, mumps, rubella, or pertussis, or any of these infectious diseases, it's going to devastate their workforce as well as, importantly, their families, because their families need to be taken care of before they're able to work. So we have a crisis in this country around support of childhood and vaccines. Another major concern we see is year after year we're developing problems with the distribution of seasonal influenza vaccine, the regular flu vaccine. 36,000 Americans die a year from seasonal flu. Now, if we ever had a preparedness event or a terrorism event that killed 36,000 Americans, it would get a lot of attention. We don't really have a robust distribution system in this country for influenza vaccine, so that there are shortages. I've had the chief of the fire chiefs call me throughout the state when I was a state commissioner to say, I can't get my folks that flu vaccine. And they want them protected if they're going to go into a home where there may be influenza to fight a fire, or if they're running an EMS squad and they're going to be carrying sick people around, both to protect themselves and because they don't want to get their patients they're carrying sick either. We have a system that is largely privatized, in which we do not have access to the information. So we do not know who's ordered vaccine in this country, where has it gone, whether that's a doctor's office, a fire station, a police station, a nursing home. That is considered proprietary information. I think this is a national resource we have got to have so we can make sure the people who need to be vaccinated get vaccinated and so that we can decrease this 36,000 deaths per year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing that I think as a preparedness community we need to consider is if on a year-to-year basis we're having difficulty getting the flu vaccine out there, why do we think that same system is going to support a pandemic influenza virus? Mm-hmm. Now, we are drilling in all the states our mass vaccination clinics and our distribution systems, but the best way to have a robust capacity for a pandemic influenza vaccine would be to have a robust capacity for year-to-year influenza vaccine distribution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, there's about 3 points you've made there I'd like to kind of drill into here. First of all, let's talk about the issue of determining priority groups. Are you finding any consensus among the states as to how to determine the priority groups?
We're in a process with the CDC where ASTO is working with them to provide information on the vaccine priorities. It's an interesting endeavor and I think a very valuable one. What we are doing is leading these public engagement meetings around the country, several of them. Two have been done to date, in which we'll go into communities, invite members of the public in. And these members of the public can be of all ages. They are not health professionals. They're just the man and woman on the street. Because no matter what we do, it has to be consistent with the values of the American people. And it has been a very interesting process, a very actually gratifying process, because the understanding of the material presented was great. I mean, members of the public truly understood the need to prioritize. In general, they do want the healthcare providers to be vaccinated, and that would include the first responders, because they want to be taken care of when they're sick. They also understand the critical need for infrastructure, whether that's the law enforcement, the fire, the people who are handling the water, the people who are keeping the electricity on. So they understood that. And one of the also very gratifying things is it wasn't an audience is talking about me. They were talking about us. So we found that for elderly people, they were saying, if you had to prioritize, I want my grandchild to have that vaccine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I would give mine up for my grandchild or for a woman who was pregnant. So, again, the American public can be a tremendous community, and we're seeing that being tapped into here. That report is not yet out. There's still some more engagements. It still has to go through clearance in the federal process, but we think it'll be an excellent report that really reflects the best science, the best practice, in terms of how the states and locals get out the vaccine, and also the best of our American values and sense of community.
Now, you also touched upon, I guess, what you'd call a tracking system for the supply, purchase, and distribution of vaccines so that it's transparent. What needs to be done to improve that capability, and who, if anybody, is doing it the best right now?
Well, there is, for example, if we go back to influenza, seasonal influenza vaccine, or childhood vaccine. There are systems in the states now. Many states have vaccine information systems where they purchase the vaccine, they either give it themselves or distribute it to doctor's offices, and then they have a record of what kid got what vaccines, what lot number. So we have that. Not uniform, not across the country as we wish it was. We need an interoperable system across the country. For the seasonal influenza, the issue we have is there is no such system. Again, as I mentioned to you earlier, we don't know who has vaccine and who doesn't have vaccine. Mm-hmm. We're also finding that the medical community, pediatricians, family physicians, and others who give vaccine are very dissatisfied right now, because what they're finding is that their patients with chronic illness don't get the vaccine because they haven't received the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And yet the large chain stores have vaccine and are giving it to any member of the public. So we're not prioritizing it for the highest mm-hmm. risk groups.
Mm-hmm.
We believe what we're seeing is a situation in which a large retailer, because they represent such purchasing power, may be being given preference over physician's offices, who any individual physician's office doesn't have much purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid that if we don't address the system, one, we won't direct vaccine to the people who really need it, and we're going to be missing those with chronic illness or who may be pregnant and otherwise who need it. But secondly, we're not far away from the physicians out there just giving up. and saying, you know what, we can't do this anymore. We don't have the tools, we don't have the vaccine supply to reliably immunize our sick people, so government, take it back over. Mm. And I don't think that's what we want.
Mm. Gee. Let's talk about points of distribution. What are your thoughts on how far we should go towards alternative pods? Can we go to prepositioning in households or workplaces or schools?
The right now we have to keep in mind, if we're talking about a pandemic influenza a vaccine, that there is no such vaccine. Mm-hmm. We don't, first of all, have a pandemic influenza yet. There is a vaccine for the strain of bird flu out there right now, but that's not a pandemic vaccine. Mm-hmm. So we will have to develop the vaccine from the point at which we can isolate the virus causing the pandemic. That is likely to take 4 months or more.
Sure.
So really we won't be able to preposition, we'll be playing catch up. It's very likely that for the first wave of a pandemic influenza, we won't have a vaccine. So we'll have to rely on the social distancing, the layered social distancing, as well as antivirals where we have them. The issue of antivirals and prepositioning is one that's still being worked out. Mm-hmm. There are certain sectors and certain private corporations who are looking at possibly prepositioning in their employees' homes. They recognize, and I think we need to recognize this for all first responders, that if a worker's family is not protected, they are not likely to come into work themselves.
In our last segment, I want to address health informatics. We've talked a lot about that recently with our HHS colleagues, notably Admiral Vanderwagen. He has the Health Information Technology Standards Panel, which made recommendations for developing common standards and interoperability in the health information technology arena. What came out of that drill that has relevance for state preparedness?
Well, it's extremely relevant that we have standards that are applicable both in the clinical sector as well as in the public health sector, so that in the public health sector we may have de-identified data, but we can do surveillance to find out there are outbreaks, clusters, for early detection, for both response and then for tracking. If we're out there prophylaxing or immunizing in response to an outbreak, we want to make sure that that is actually slowing down the curve of the illness. So the issue here is that the standards are developing so rapidly that it's very difficult to be at the table and involved as each standard is developed to assure that they are relevant for the public health and response community as well as the clinical community. And even when you come up with there's a laboratory standard called LOINC. That is an umbrella. There are many, many standards underneath that individually have to be developed. So it's extremely resource intense. We recently convened ASTO and NACHO, which is the city and county health officials, and others convened a meeting in which we brought the public health partners together to say, okay, how do we as a field work together to make sure we are at the table making these decisions along with the clinical community? Lots of work, but we can't miss this window of opportunity to make sure that any e-health system we have is both a public health and a clinical system.
Well, is it possible to have a national standard?
We have to have national standards. Mm-hmm. We have to have national standards. Now, that doesn't mean we'll have one information system. That doesn't practically work. In fact, if you go to an ATM machine anywhere in the world, you can pull money out of your bank account, but it's not one system. It's an interoperable system. The standards allow the different systems to talk to each other and work together. So that's what we really need to shoot for.
Mm-hmm. Now, with regard to information sharing, what's the status on methods, protocols, and defined coordination roles for information sharing?
Rapid development. As we speak, there's many parties working on this, and that, I think, is the challenge for us, is that none of us have the full-time staff to devote to this, but that's basically what it takes. So we're looking at perhaps working across the states to develop a resource that we all share in. But we have to figure this out. We have mm-hmm. to be at the table.
Now, one last question. All of this effort on informatics, how do the initiatives and efforts tally with the privacy and confidentiality concerns?
Well, it's a critical component that we have to work on. Frankly, in terms of the security of a system, I think that an electronic system is far more secure than a paper system. Anyone who comes into a doctor's office after hours, whether it's somebody working on equipment or cleaning the office, can walk away with a paper record. So that's a real threat. Where people get concerned, though, is when you aggregate that information as you would an electronic system, people can go fishing. It's not carrying out one record. They maybe have access to hundreds of records. So we need to make sure that we have a good security there so the system can't be hacked into. And I think that technology is there. The other issue is privacy. Okay, so you have legitimate access to the system, but whose record can you get to? Do you really have a right to get to a different doctor's or a different jurisdiction's population? And the answer there would be not without good reason. So we have to build that security in, that privacy factors in also. Major issue, we've got to work on it. In my own personal experience, when I built along with Commissioner Sleeper in public safety in Vermont, we built a prescription monitoring program to look at prescription drugs, to look at diversion and inappropriate use. The party that we worked the most with, we had to work with the doctors. They were worried about, being busted for giving business, but it was the American Civil Liberties Union. I spent most of my time with them because of that concern about privacy and security of a system if records were aggregated. We did work through it in that case. They assured me that while they couldn't support the initiative, they wouldn't fight it, and they would reserve the right to sue me. So, but that in politics is a success.
Well, Dr. Jarris, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you especially for your service to our country.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness Podcast interview. Thank you for listening.